on your willingness and ability to do it in such a way. When I play the piano, I depend only on myself. But of course, it was extremely useful for me to come to the symphonies after having had such a long experience for so many years with every other kind of Beethoven composition.
And where did your conducting of Beethoven start? With which symphony and with which orchestra?
Number 4 I conducted in the class in Salzburg in 1955, and then 8. And then I think it must have been my first so-called professional engagement. I say so-called because I'm not sure I was such a professional. It was the Second Symphony in Haifa, in the north Israel. And the first time I conducted the Ninth Symphony was in Manchester. And it was Bob Rowley, whom I felt very close to, and I played with him a lot. And he said to me, "Have you ever conducted the Ninth Beethoven?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, you should." And anyway, he not only pushed me into it, but he gave me access, which I suppose today is much easier to get to than then. I'm talking about 1969. He gave me access to the Wagner changes of instrumentation in the Ninth Symphony. And then I conducted it in Manchester.
It's fascinating to hear you talk of your good friend and musical partner, Sir John Bob Rowley, in connection to Beethoven.
Yeah.
Because I think, obviously, in the UK, we might think of him with other sorts of repertoire. And probably thinking of your Beethoven tradition, in addition to Bob Rowley, then
Klemperer,
Furtwängler. So do you feel then in a particular line of Beethoven performance tradition?
I don't know. Let me evade a direct answer.
I might try again later.
When I think of the piano sonatas, how I really got to know them and what was the way for me, even after I had learned them and played them, to continue growing them, were of course the different editions of the great pianists. You know, the Urtext editions were just beginning to come out in the 60s, I think the Henley edition came out, but I had the Schnabel edition of the complete piano sonatas. I had Eugen Dalbert. I had some sonatas, not all, of Bülow, a lot of that. And that's really what I grew up. And at that time, I thought that all of them were part of one tradition, of one way of seeing and of playing the music, which of course is not true. It's like with the conductors also, you know, especially with conductors who conducted the same orchestra, one after another, and then you feel it was the same music making, and it wasn't. I remember in the 60s when Karajan had already been about 13 or 14 years with the Berlin Philharmonic, and out in Berlin or in Vienna, they talked about the differences between Karajan and Furtwängler. But outside in London, and it was the same thing. It was the Berlin Philharmonic and the same line, you know. And I think both Furtwängler and Karajan both would have been horrified at being mentioned in the same sentence. No, really, you know. And so it depends very much how you look at this. I mean, I was always extremely interested in the way of reading between the lines of all these pianists that I had mentioned now, and also Edwin Fischer, whom I had the great privilege to get to know as a boy. And with the conductors, I heard Furtwängler conduct only one symphonic program, and that was the Eighth Symphony, the Große Fuge, and the Seventh Symphony. And I was, of course, bowled over, but I cannot claim that I knew why. I was 11 years old.
But Klemm...
I liked all this. But then later I understood what it meant.
But Klemperer, you saw.
Klemperer, I played all the Beethoven concertos with, and I recorded them all with him. Klemperer was. Klemperer belonged to no line, to no tradition. He was really by himself, as actually was Furtwängler too. I think Furtwängler probably belonged a little bit to the line before that. But Klemperer, you know, Klemperer was, by the time I played with him for the first time in 1967, must have been early 67, he was already of a certain age. I don't remember exactly when he was born, but he was already of a certain age, and he had had his stroke, and he had burned himself, and all this. He was not exactly a picture of health, and he had great difficulty moving, but this monster, he was 2 meters high when he stood up. And he would sit on the chair and he could hardly move that, and somehow the arms would come up and then they come down, and there was a sound that I had never heard before nor since. Granite. It was like stone, like solid, very sculptured stone. I can't describe it another way. Klemperer had no interest whatsoever in beauty of sound or this, all these things. It was basically this kind of very, very sculptured sound and balance. And balance.
And those are things which obviously made a big impact on you. And have you simply taken those then as part, a rich part of your own musical personality, or do
yes.
you find different
I mean,
things in
by the time I met Klemperer, which was, as I said, in 1967, I had heard, played for, and therefore met Furtwängler in 1954. So it's about 13 years earlier, and those 13 years were the years of my sort of youth, early adult. And I became extremely fascinated with the whole musical phenomenon, Furtwängler. The non-musical side, all the problems, whether it was had been right for him to stay in Germany or not, also interested me. But for the purpose of this conversation, the music really fascinated me. And I read every word that he had written, and he wrote quite a bit, and listened to his recordings, and I was fascinated by the fact that you could not separate the thought from the emotion in Furtwängler. Very often there was a sort of very extreme agitated thing. You think, oh, that's so highly emotional. And then when you really look at the score, you realize that there was a very good structural sense for him to do so. Klemperer had none of that. And I talked to him a lot about Furtwängler, and he had no patience and no interest in that. He thought this was just Furtwängler's idiosyncrasies and Furtwängler's subjectivity, and that this had nothing to do with the music. Although he recognized that he was a great conductor. But this influenced me tremendously. And of course, like everything that one admires or is fascinated by, one tries to imitate. And I don't remember who it was that said that small talent imitates, great talent steals. Because the talent is so great that once he has stolen it, it has become his. And so I came from all this thing for Furtwängler, and I started to try to do the same thing very often and to try and imagine what he would have thought. You know, and I was very proud of the fact that not one day passed in my musical life where in some way I was not thinking of him and what he would do with this phrase or with this transition, because Furtwängler's originality of thought had to do with the fact that he made a very clear difference between music that is that starts with a sense of being here and others that become with a sense of becoming. Furtwängler was about to and fro and about the transitions. I don't think Klemperer was so interested. I may be doing him an injustice, but I don't think he was so interested in transitions. He had a statement, the statement was finished, he turned a page, and then came the next statement. There was something extraordinarily matter of fact, but in fact, it was the fact of the matter, and not the matter of fact. It's not just a silly play of words I'm doing. It was really that. And I must say that my encounter with Klemperer brought me to revise so many things and wonder whether I could not achieve a synthesis between these two great mountains, Furtwängler and Klemperer. And now I'm coming to what you really wanted to hear, the answer. And I have conducted the symphony, Beethoven symphonies, I don't know how many times. It also makes no difference. But these are works, of course, that have accompanied me all my life. I still believe that I learned to think the music in Furtwänglerian terms. But without in any way without in any way being critical of him or thinking I know better, I don't mean that way at all, I've tried in the last 5 to 10 years to see whether a lot of the abrupt changes and transitional changes that he did so inimitably, wonderfully, could not be done just with the change of color, with the change of balance, with more emphasis on the harmonic changes rather than on with extreme changes of tempo. So I'm in no way claiming that I think I do the symphonies now better than I did. And by this I don't mean, of course, to say that I did it so well before that there was no room for improvement. But I don't mean that at all, but I'm sharing with you a little bit my thought process. And I think that the musicians in the orchestra today have the technical capacity, and in this orchestra, the musical ability to think that one can make this experiment. My God, that was a long answer. I'm sorry.
Maestro Daniel Barenboim, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Daniel Barenboim talking to Proms director and controller of BBC Radio 3, Roger Wright, in that Proms Plus event recorded at the Royal College of Music just over the road here from the Royal Albert Hall just before the doors opened for tonight's prom. Details of all the Proms Plus events on the Proms website, where you'll also find the Proms blog and daily 3-minute Proms music guides, in addition to everything you could hope to want to discover about each prom every day. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's prom, the first concert in Daniel Barenboim's complete cycle of all 9 Beethoven symphonies. Now, of course, this is a hugely exciting prospect, playing all of these symphonies in a relatively short space of time, just a week or so, but it's also a massive challenge for the conductor and the players. The West Eastern Divan Orchestra cellist Nasib Al-Ahmadi and Lenore Katz from Israel told me about the special relationship between this orchestra and this composer, Beethoven.
We worked a lot, so I feel like we're very ready by now to perform these marvelous pieces. And I feel that playing the whole cycle is so powerful and brings the best out of the orchestra so far. We played lots of repertoire before, but there is something about playing the complete cycle that is even more powerful.
Is it possible to say what that special thing is? Is it a combination of the music and the scale?
I mean, the
of
music
thing?
Of Beethoven is very powerful in itself, and it's very classical in a sense that the orchestra has to be really disciplined. The other thing is that repeating these pieces for over, now the orchestra exists for 13 years, and we always had one of the Beethoven symphonies on tour with other programs. So this is getting like part of the orchestra. The sound of the orchestra is around the Beethoven cycle, kind of.
Does it mean something special to you then, as a group coming to these pieces? I'm thinking also that the recordings you released of the cycle earlier this year, Beethoven for All. I mean, there is a message going along here about what Beethoven's music means, not just for this orchestra as a symbol of cultures coming together, but even for the world. Do you feel that when you play?
Well, I feel that each symphony symbolizes something different in Beethoven's mind or ideas, and maybe this is a symbol for what each of us feels and the different people in the orchestra.
Beethoven is probably the most popular composer of all times, you know, and it's not for no reason. His music is universal, and everybody on earth is playing Beethoven and enjoying Beethoven, which cannot be said about all composers and all music. And playing them for us in this situation, in our orchestra, with the backgrounds of our political and cultural differences, it's even more meaningful, I think.
Naseeb Al-Ahmadi from Lebanon and Lenore Katz from Israel, two cellists of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. Right, and so to Beethoven's Second Symphony. Now consider this. At the time, at its first performance in 1802, this was the longest, grandest, and loudest symphony ever written in musical history. But it's a piece whose energy, self-confidence, and sense of abandon were composed at a time of major turmoil for Beethoven. He despaired at his prospects for the future because he was aware, for the first time really, of what was happening to his hearing, and he set down his near-suicidal feelings in a so-called Heiligenstadt Testament, a letter he wrote but didn't send to his brothers. And yet the symphony's boldness belies any sense of self-pity or resignation. There's the scale of the slow introduction we hear first, the concentration of the tunes and the way they're worked in the opening allegro, the emotional range, the huge emotional range of the slow movement, the ferocity of the scherzo's third movement, so called for the first time in symphonic history, and the wildness of the finale. The whole thing is irresistible in the momentum it creates. This is a piece, just like the First Symphony, which matters on its own terms more than what it prefigures for the rest of Beethoven's symphonies. And yet, if you know those later pieces well, you'll be able to hear clues. There are even tremors that seem to look forward in time to the Ninth Symphony in what you hear in the Second, the way that B-flat major and D major are put against one another, right almost from the very start. Beethoven does a very similar thing in the Ninth Symphony. And actually, there's a wonderful thing, thinking back to the First Symphony that we heard in the first half. When that piece was first performed, it would have appeared on the program not as Symphony No. 1 by Ludwig van Beethoven, but as Symphony in C. These pieces are pieces of new music. Certainly, that's what Daniel Barenboim believes. He comes on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall now to lead the West Eastern Divan Orchestra in Beethoven's Second Symphony in D major.
Thank you.
the end of Beethoven's Second Symphony here at the Royal Albert Hall. Daniel Barenboim conducted the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. Barenboim extends his arms to this huge Brahms audience and around his orchestra too. One Viennese critic for a magazine called the Zeitung für die elegante Welt, the newspaper for the elegant world, when the piece was premiered in April 1803, in fact, famously wrote of the Second Symphony that this was a hideously writhing, wounded dragon that refuses to die, but writhing in its last agonies, and in the fourth movement, bleeding to death. Well, it must be proof, I guess, of this audience, and speaking personally, me too, that we like watching dragons being pummeled, beaten, and killed to death, musically speaking. That music is completely thrilling. And actually, that contemporary report catches something of the extremity of this music, an extremity and an essentialness about it, that this orchestra, the West Eastern Divan Orchestra, and its young players, and Daniel Barenboim, communicated and realized tonight. This, of course, is only the end of the first of six concerts that make up this cycle of Beethoven's nine symphonies, a bit of chamber music and the music of Pierre Boulez too, that climaxes next Friday with the ninth symphony. I'll be back for all the concerts tomorrow night, the fourth symphony, the Eroica, and Pierre Boulez's Dialogue de l'Ombre Double. But now, from this thrilled, ravished, and dragon-wounding Royal Albert Hall, time to hand you back John Shea at Broadcasting House.
Thank you, Tom. And we'll be venturing back into the Dragon's Den with Tom Service, Beethoven, and Daniel Barenboim at the West Eastern Divan Orchestra at 7:30 tomorrow evening. Before then, in the afternoon, Mahan Esfahani will be recreating the spirit of Bach's Leipzig Coffeehouse concerts in the first of this year's Proms Saturday matinees. He'll be playing his own arrangement of Bach's The Art of Fugue with the Academy of Ancient Music. That's at Cadogan Hall and live on Radio 3 at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. And I see there are also a couple of Proms Plus family events. If you'd like to know how to sign up for those tomorrow, then do have a look at the Proms Guide or the Proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms. It's 3 minutes past 10 this Friday night on BBC Radio 3. The essay is 45 minutes away. But first, Tristram Hunt concludes his series this week of Great British Ideas, looking at how ideas born in Britain have spread beyond our shores. In this programme, he traces the tale of the bourgeois British liberal who inspired Lenin.
On a screen on a wall in the National Army Museum in London is an eerie piece of film. It's 1899. A square of maybe 100 British soldiers, standing stock still on a raft, are being tugged slowly across a South African river to an uncertain fate amidst ambushes and skirmishes and the sieges of the Boer War. The Empire had called.
Not ours to throw the gauntlet down or hard defiance were, not ours to give the challenge, no battle flag unfurl. We banded for defence alone to guard our native land, no thought of foreign conquest upon a distant strand.
This is a story in the mould of John Buchan and the 39 Steps, of gold and steel, of prospectors, colonial wars, and shadowy financiers pulling the strings of politicians, of imperial intrigue and radical liberal anger, and of revolutionaries plotting in London backrooms whose schemes will change the world. A few months before those soldiers were tugged into battle, as the British Empire and the Boer Republic geared up for war, a 40-year-old Englishman arrived to cover the escalating political crisis for the Manchester Guardian. His name was John Atkinson Hobson, and what he found in South Africa was to crystallise an idea in his mind, a vision of the true nature of empire, that was to establish the foundations of anti-imperialism, a philosophy that would come to travel the world. To rediscover the story of how this neglected English journalist had such a profound influence. I've come to the National Army Museum in Chelsea, in London, to meet Professor Peter Kane, author of Hobson and Imperialism. Peter, who was John Hobson?
Well, John Hobson was a provincial liberal. He was born in Derby, the son of a rather prosperous newspaper proprietor. And he admitted later on that in his early years he'd been rather complacent about the capitalist system and about imperialism. But when he went to London from the mid-90s onwards, he began to notice the poverty.
So he comes from the north of England with a belief in that free trade, enterprise, mid-Victorian model. He comes to London, discovers poverty and the causes of poverty, but then begins to link it to international events. How does that work?
In the early 90s, Hobson came increasingly to recognise that capitalism maldistributed income and wealth, and that meant that the masses didn't get enough of what was produced and the rich got too much. The result was that the rich oversaved, and Hobson argued that the only real outlet for this oversaving that would bring a return to the rich was foreign investment. And he began increasingly to see foreign investment as the crucial reason for overseas expansion. It was finding new markets for foreign investment and carefully protecting the places where investments had already been made.
So underconsumption at home means you have to put your money round the world. That's what's driving imperialism and then the defence of those imperial interests.
That's right. And he had clearly worked this out theoretically as early as 1898. And it was that which interested the Manchester Guardian and was the reason why he was sent to South Africa to investigate the crisis that was beginning. Once he gets to South Africa, he really gets angry about the situation. And he begins to see the mine owners, led by Cecil Rhodes, as the key figures in manipulating the British into fighting the local population, the Dutch, in order to improve mining profits.
Because very soon after Hobson goes out into South Africa, Britain is at war. Tell us about the genesis of the Boer War.
The argument that the British government was putting forward was that it was actually defending the rights of British subjects in the Transvaal Republic, the Dutch Republic, and the argument that Hobson put forward was that this was in fact simply a ruse, that what they were there to do was to actually improve the conditions for the mining capitalists and improve the profits of the finance capitalists. And he felt that the whole aim of the war was fundamentally economic, but people were misled into believing that there was a kind of moral purpose behind it.
Now, one of the key figures he identifies in terms of this ideology of imperialism is Cecil Rhodes. What was his critique of Rhodes and the power of Rhodes?
Well, what brought Rhodes to Hobson's attention was the famous Jameson Raid of 1895 initially, when Rhodes tried to overthrow the local Afrikaner government in order to further his capitalist interests in South Africa. And from that point on, Hobson was extremely distrustful of Rhodes. And of course, Rhodes was also a very big political figure. He was actually Prime Minister of the Cape for a considerable period in the 1890s. And so many people on the left actually see Rhodes as the chief villainous figure, if you like, as the person who epitomises economic imperialism.
Mr. Rhodes, designed to use the armed forces of the British Crown and the money of the British taxpayer to obtain for himself and his fellow capitalists that political control of the Transvaal which was essential to his economical and political ambitions. To do this, it was above all things necessary to apply an adequate motive power to the minds of the British government and the British people. For this to work, he found the press by far the aptest instrument. John Hobson, The War in South Africa, Its Causes and Effects, 1900.
You might think the archetypal Victorian imperialist was a conservative, but Cecil Rhodes was no such thing. And as Tony Webster, a historian at Liverpool John Moores University, points out, his deeply held faith in empire was, to Hobson's frustration, held across the political spectrum.
even the political left, as represented, for example, by the Webbs in the Fabian Society, had quite strong pro-imperial leanings. And within the Liberal Party as well, that pro-imperial sentiment had become much stronger. In this respect, Hobson is very much setting himself up even against people who you might expect to be his natural allies.
Here we see a cartoon in front of us from the Illustrated London News of top-hatted city gentlemen throwing their hats into the end, and it says the reaction on the stock exchange to the news of the Boer surrender at Paardeberg, 1900. But there's rather an interesting figure on the far right of it, isn't there?
Well, there's a figure who's clearly drawn as a kind of Jewish financier, if you like. And there is no doubt about it that Hobson was quite ambivalent about this side of financial imperialism. He did show some kind of anti-Semitic strain.
And the figure we see before us is physically larger than the others. There's the crooked caricature, Jewish nose, sideburns. And he's not celebrating, he's overlooking it, as if to suggest, well, this was all in the plan. And is this meant to be, in a sense, the symbol not so much of a Rhodes as of a Rothschild?
Yes, I think so. And I think the implication is that although Rhodes is a very prominent figure, it's the senior men in the city who are fundamentally in charge of this operation, this imperialist operation.
Surely there was more than enough to critique in the imperial project and its links with the city without going down the Semitic route.
Yes, I think it was a mistake. What it reflected is the very widespread anti-Semitic sentiment amongst English intellectuals at that time. But the fact is that the theory worked perfectly well without invoking any kind of Jewish conspiracy. What you have fundamentally is what Hobson thinks of as a city conspiracy, not a Jewish conspiracy as such. And the theory will work perfectly well without introducing the anti-Semitic element.
Either way, when we look at the power on display at the stock exchange, when we look at the politicians, the financiers behind the imperial project, it suggests some of the strength of the consensus that Hobson was up against, doesn't it?
Oh, yes.
Meanwhile, a stranger arrived in the heart of the empire. On the 14th of April, 1902, here at Charing Cross Station, Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, better known as Lenin, arrived with his wife, Krupskaya, from the continent. This was a city far bigger than he had ever encountered. The weather, much like today, was dreadful. But as they stepped out into the stronghold of the great capitalist imperium, Lenin's wife records that his face immediately brightened as he began to marvel at the sheer power and scale of London. Lenin and Krupskaya got to know London by crisscrossing it on the buses. Sitting next to me on an open-top bus pushing east through the middle of London is Professor Christopher Reed, the University of Warwick, author of Lenin, A Revolutionary Life. Chris, what did Lenin see? What did he enjoy on these bus rides he took through the heart of London?
Well, Lenin was kind of knocked out by London. He was fascinated by capitalism. He wanted to know what its inner secrets was. And he could see everything. We're currently passing the Royal Courts of Justice, one of the great elements of the state. You could see all these great symbols of the establishment. He went through upper class areas, Knightsbridge, Mayfair and so on, and then went to the extremes of East End and other working class suburbs. And according to his wife Krupskaya, when they were sitting on the bus, he would mutter to himself, two nations, two nations.
As we cross Ludgate Circus and head towards